Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing pretty well. I had a little funny thing happen to me this morning.
Oh, funny. Do tell.
That I want to share with you. But I want to start with a question. Why is it that I can get, my daughter will eat rocks or rubble or marbles, but lettuce not so much. I haven't quite figured that out. I came downstairs today, and my wife is laughing, and my daughter is sitting at the kitchen table, and she's gotten into the Altoids. The curiously strong mints.
I bet she smells great.
Hold on. And she's got like 11 of them in her mouth.
Uh-huh.
And she's shoving them in her mouth as fast as she can. And her eyes are watering. Okay? There are tears coming out. She's not crying. There are tears coming out of her eyes because it's so
minty
and strong. And yet she continues to put them in her mouth. And I keep thinking, is broccoli that bad? Okay, shouldn't
no,
why
no, I think it's the same thing as people who like to eat hot food or spicy food. There are these ginger candies that I eat all the time.
I think it's that she's 2 years old and she wants to eat whatever I don't want her to.
No. I think it has to do with the whole pain thing. I mean, it's like eating hot peppers. It's like hurts, but then you want another one.
I told you about, I had a doctor a while back, and on my very last visit to him, this doctor was 320 pounds, 6 foot tall, and he was talking to me one day about, you know, you really need to lose some weight. And I'm looking at him going, huh? What are you talking about? Okay.
You're bigger than I am.
And anyway, he's talking to me about, you know, eating, and, you know, I'm talking to him about the restaurants. He's like, yeah, I got this real issue. I love salt and vinegar potato chips, and I will eat salt and vinegar potato chips until the sides of my mouth crack and start to bleed. And then I'll just keep eating them. I can't stop. And the salt and vinegar will get in the cracks in the sides of my mouth, and I'll keep eating them. I can't stop. And I thought, I'm never coming back here again.
Yeah, time to change doctors is what that is.
I'm never returning to,
time to change
to this
doctors.
Place. But I get, you know, I guess it's the same thing that makes us eat Captain Crunch. And even though it chews up the roof of our mouth, you know, when you're a kid, didn't you ever eat that second bowl of Captain Crunch, even though you knew it was going to rough up the roof of your mouth?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, no.
Oh, well, most of the listeners are thinking how nuts you are.
Yeah.
Because Captain Crunch, if you eat one bowl of Captain Crunch, it's totally fine. If you eat two bowls, and, you know, as a kid, I ate my share of Captain Crunch, I'll be honest with you. If you eat two bowls of Captain Crunch, your mouth only has so much tolerance for the abrasiveness of Captain Crunch, that stuff that makes it stay crunchy in the milk.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it stays crunchy. That stuff that makes it stay crunchy abuses the roof of your mouth, and it will rough up the surface of your mouth and actually hurt. And it's much like the salt and vinegar potato chips.
Do you do it again? Do you eat more?
Of course you do it. Well, you don't have a third bowl. Okay, you just eat, first of all, because you're not hungry anymore. But second of all, because your mouth really hurts now. But I guess it's that same thing, the Captain Crunch in the roof of your mouth, the salt and vinegar in the sides of your, make the sides of your mouth bleed, and the Altoids until you're a crying 2-year-old sitting at my table.
This is one of those pleasures that I missed, and I don't feel the need to rush out and get one. But on the subject of putting salt in a wound, we should share with our listeners our recent experience. We were walking down the streets of Manhattan, and we came across a place that we've made fun of before. And you made us go in and get a drink.
I really did.
We were passing.
We had about 15 minutes to spare. We were going to be early for the next thing we were going
next
to.
Next meeting.
And I said, we're going past. We have to go in. And
we went to the Hawaiian Tropic Zone. The Hawaiian Tropic Zone is a restaurant in Manhattan that's supposedly a real restaurant. It looked like a real restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Except that, and David Burke is the chef there. I don't know why he's chosen to get involved in something. And I don't think it's wrong. I think it should be allowed to be, but I find it in poor taste, and I don't care for it. I would never involve myself in it. But it's where the waitresses serve you food in
sarongs and bikinis,
like open sarongs, like bikini tops and bikini bottoms.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, look, a go-go bar is a go-go bar. You know what you're getting into. A fine dining restaurant, you know, women have faced discrimination on the floors of restaurants for a long time. When you meld the two, now this is a restaurant with windows on two sides. You can look right in, and believe me, there were a lot of dirty old men staring in the window of the Hawaiian Tropic Zone at the waitresses in these rather small bikinis, serving tables full of businessmen, and there were women in there as well. Mm-hmm. The food looked halfway decent. There was a reasonable cocktail menu.
Absolutely.
It was ooky, though. It was ooky.
I remember what you said when I
were
sitting at the bar.
Can I get it? Please.
You have to.
And we both were like, and we've been in a go-go bar together. It's not something we've done before, but in our past,
you go to a bachelor party or whatever.
And, you know, I don't feel uncomfortable there, but I really felt ooky and like, well, first of all, it's incongruous to see a woman in a Hawaiian print bikini on Broadway, okay, in windows on both sides with the dirty old men looking in from outside.
It's also incongruous to say, you know, what do you think about the 76 Burgundies on the list?
Or even, it was just uncomfortable to me, and I think it should be uncomfortable to you, and that's my view. But, you know, if you enjoy it. But Mark and I are trying to figure out just what was making us so uncomfortable. As we thought it would make us uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And the line that I came up with is a line I've heard used before.
I'm going to tell you truthfully, you know, we've joked about the place and talked about the concept of the place, but I really did feel uncomfortable when I walked in.
And it's a nice room.
You know,
it's clean.
It's a nice room.
Got a
menu,
bar.
But I really did feel uncomfortable. I really did feel like I was cheating on my wife a little bit while I was in there.
Well, you know, Mark said, you know, now why is this so uncomfortable? I mean, you know, we've been around women in bikinis before. Mm-hmm. I'm like, and this is what I said. I said, you know, a bikini is a bathing suit, unless you're wearing high heels, then it's lingerie. Okay, that's when the bikini crosses from being just a bathing suit to being
right. And you're no longer my waiter. You're actually on a catwalk.
Yeah, it was just a bizarre thing, and I'm not for it. I'm against it.
Well, you know, certainly a fair amount of our listeners are going to go to places like Hawaiian Tropic Zone. Some, because of this particular show, are going to go to Hawaiian
Tropic
Zone.
And maybe some of our listeners, if they're dirty old men but don't have the cojones to go in, can just go stand at the window. But the guys were like, you know, it was sunny out, and they were putting their...
No joke, this happened Francis and I were in the place for all of 12 minutes, and no joke, 4 or 5 times, people would press their faces against the window.
And hold their hands over their eyes
and
to shade.
Shield the sun so they could look inside at the girls of the Hawaii Tropic
Zone. How does that work? I think that in you have to hire them, because obviously you can't, if they get fat, you got to fire them. If they, you know, can't hire men.
It's like the Borgata Babes in New Jersey a while back.
I think what they did was they would have to hire them, I'm conjecturing now, they hire them as models who serve drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can find them.
I will tell you, the women in the place were very good looking.
Well, okay. I got a date with one of them. But no, I didn't really get a date. Jennifer, if you're listening, I didn't really get a date. No, I mean, it was.
He tried. He just failed.
It was profoundly uncomfortable, and you won't be seeing that at Stage Left Your Cat in the Body.
No, not today.
Hey, we'll be back in just a moment.
I don't look great in a bikini.
Talking with great Ray Isle, who's a great food writer, senior wine editor for Food and Wine magazine. Back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're talking today with Ray Isle. He's one of our favorite wine writers. He is the senior wine editor at Food and Wine magazine, James Beard nominee, among other things.
Ray, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
You know, we were talking briefly with Ray before the break and during the commercial, and Mark said to Ray, he said, you know, we read your stuff all the time, and we just, like, put it in a file, and when it gets big enough, we just call Ray and have him on the show. We love that.
A massive accumulation of information.
Well, you know, the other thing about your writing, Ray, is you know, being in the business, you know, what's happening and what people are talking about, you really do hit the trends on the head. And one of the things that we see a lot now, and it's really entered the mainstream, it went from, I think there's this way something happens, the way an idea grows. It goes from, like, uber wine geeks and mm-hmm. top sommeliers
mm-hmm. right.
to, like, the wine cognoscenti who want to be on the next trend, and then about 2, 3, 4 years later, it goes into the mainstream. Well, something that's really hit the mainstream, that you, what I mean by that is you'll see it advertised on a commercial or on a shelf talker in a supermarket wine aisle, is biodynamics. Now, we see that in organics, in agriculture overall, but we see people advertising that their wine is biodynamic. And you've written about that recently.
Yeah,
well,
I
let's talk
have,
about
actually.
That. Well, first of all, Ray, biodynamic is such a great word. I mean, it's bio, it's dynamic.
I mean, it sounds wonderful. It sounds sort of like, you know, healthy and active at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. So why don't you give us, because I could tell our listening audience what biodynamics is, but that would be the whole show, because I'm not very good at making things concise.
Do a sort of quick, the concise biodynamics.
Yeah, what is biodynamics? What is biodynamics, and why does it appeal specifically to winemakers over other agricultural concerns, though it's another agricultural concern.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. Biodynamics is unusual in that it has, really does have both a spiritual aspect and a straightforward organic farming aspect. And that's actually been the kind of controversial thing about it. It's an organic farming movement based on some lectures that a philosopher named Rudolf Steiner gave, an Austrian philosopher gave in the 1920s. And essentially, the sort of nut of the whole thing is it sees the vineyard or farm, because there are plenty of biodynamic, you know, farms that aren't vineyards. It sees the farm as a kind of entire organism. So the plant life, the soil, the sort of, you know, microbial life in the soil, the bugs in the farm, the, you know, the sheep that are grazing on the cover crops, the atmosphere around it are all kind of interconnected. In, if you follow biodynamic sensibility. And they kind of extend that as well to the you know, quote unquote astral forces, you know, the actions of the cosmos, I guess you'd say.
But not just moving in sync, but almost contingent upon one another.
Yes, exactly. And essentially, what you aim to do in biodynamics is you try and get all of those pieces of the puzzle, as it were, to work together, and to work together in such a way that you don't need chemical fertilizers, you don't need pesticides, you don't, and in fact, it's, you know, it's forbidden under the sort of biodynamic regimen to use any of that thing. The idea is that if once you have the farm in balance, it much like a human body being healthy, it's more resistant to disease and it's more resistant to pests, and additionally it produces better fruit and consequently better wines.
Okay. Now, 15 years ago, this was kooky hippies were talking about this, right?
Yep.
And now, Ray, just for those of you who don't know Ray has been published in the Washington Post, Martha Stewart Living, Gastronomica. He's appeared on CNN Headline News and CNBC High Net Worth. So you're a pretty down-to-earth, serious wine journalist talking about astral forces.
Yes. Well, I do talk about the astral forces part with a slight grain of salt. A grain of cosmic salt or something.
Cosmic dust, as it were.
Yeah, cosmic dust. I think that, I mean, that's where biodynamics gets kind of weird, because when you say, you know, you need to harvest when the moon is moving through the house of Jupiter or something like that, that a lot of people who follow biodynamics claim, that is a very loud phone on my, it'll go away. A lot of people on the biodynamics claim that these forces are, in fact, tangible when you taste the wine that's made from them. But there's no scientific way of proving that any of this is having an effect.
What biodynamics
does make you do, regardless of all the spiritual stuff, is it forces you to pay incredibly close attention in the vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a positive effect no matter what. So it's very hard to separate out, you know, which aspects of biodynamics are making the wine better in what way.
Well, and certainly that's the debate that we've had here, and we've had this debate a couple of times on the show, where, you know, are biodynamic wines on average better than non-biodynamic wines? I think
yes.
That the answer is clearly yes.
But is it because to be a biodynamic winemaker, you just need to pay such close attention, because if you make the slightest mistake and you can't use chemicals to save yourself, you're in a lot of trouble. So maybe it's just that biodynamic winemakers pay extremely close attention to their vineyards, looking at every plant every day.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. There isn't margin for error. Though it's interesting, because the recent harvest in Loire was very, essentially very damp. There's a lot of mold and mildew and so on. And Nicolas Joly, who's the king of biodynamics,
right,
was saying that essentially there was no real difference in terms, I mean, everybody's grapes were affected by this weather, and And if you look at the biodynamic grapes, and you know the surf skeptics were saying, you guys are going to get wiped out by this. You don't have treatments to stop it. He said actually that the grapes are about as healthy in both biodynamic and the ones that have been zapped with 900 pounds of chemicals.
Yeah, high priest is a much better word to use than king when you're talking about biodynamics.
Yes, it is.
And France, as a matter of fact, if you want to think that through. Hey, this is we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more with Ray Isle, senior wine editor of Food & Wine Magazine, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Captain Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis are talking with Ray Isle, senior wine editor at Food & Wine Magazine. We're talking about biodynamic wines. If you go to your liquor store, you go to a good wine shop, you will see a number of wines that say biodynamic on the label. You'll see other wines that maybe don't say it on the label, but if you talk to the guy in the wine shop or you talk to your sommelier in the restaurant, they'll know what some of the biodynamic wines are. They generally represent a higher quality. Ray, I want to throw something out to you. We were talking before the break about there's a certain hocus-pocus element to biodynamics, which talks about aligning the astral forces and using those as a guide to pick as when to pick and when to plant and when to prune. You know, Barbara Shin with David Page, her husband, owns Shin Vineyard out in Long Island, and they utilize a lot of biodynamic practices. And I was out there and we did an interview with her. And I think she made a great point. She said, look, I'm a cynical New Yorker, and I do some things in keeping with biodynamic winemaking that I know it works. And there's a biodynamic explanation that has to do with the astral forces. Am I sure that's why it works? No. But do I need to know why something works to do it, as long as I know that it works? You know, and a lot of these ancient agricultural practices were tied to the lunar calendar. And maybe they didn't work because of the power of the moon god, but it was still a good idea to plant and harvest through experience at those times. Do you think that there may just be forces at work that we don't understand the exact functioning of them, but, you know, do you need to understand it to be able to use it?
Well, I mean, absolutely. There could be forces at work that we don't understand. That's true of all life, and especially since we don't understand them. We don't know what they're doing. So, I do think that, that one reason biodynamics has become popular with some very, very good winemakers and very smart winemakers. I mean, Olivier Zinhombrecht, for instance, has a PhD in I forget what branch of science. I mean, he's not a credible, a gullible guy. I think that the reason that people shift to it is when they start working with it, it does create, and at least taste-wise, a distinct difference in the wine that is a positive difference. And I agree with Barbara. If you do something and you don't know why it works, and yet it makes your wine better,
do it again.
Don't stop doing it.
Hey, yeah. we're gonna take a break. We're gonna go listen to the news. When we come back, we're gonna talk with Ray. He's come up with, one of the hardest things to do in the wine business is coming up with rules to pair food and wine. It's more art than science. And Ray's come up with 7 rules that you can follow to match your wine and food at home, and we think they're pretty good and pretty useful. We'll talk about those after the news. 1450 WCTC. It's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You
can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Ray Isle is the senior wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. In addition to being broadly published, he's one of our favorite wine writers. He was nominated for a James Beard Award, and he joins us today to talk about, well, wine.
Wine. And why not?
Ray, I'm going to tell you that I find a lot of wine writers write in very complex ways, and I think that can be very difficult for the novice reader. And one of the things I enjoy about your writing, while you write about the complexities of wine, and you write very intelligently, that what you do is you kind of break this down for someone who may not be an expert. Because let's face it, of the people I talk to every day, 1 or 2% of them are experts, and 98% of them are novices. So when, and I'm sure that's true of your readers as well, that you know, there's some level of acumen as far as wine knowledge, but basically most people are somewhere in that middle.
Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely true.
One of the difficult things, we teach wine classes all the time. We've done it for, 20 years now, right? And it's fun. We really enjoy teaching about wine because I think that when people get a frame of reference for wine, it's much easier for them to then go off on their own and learn more and enjoy the wine a lot more with a frame of reference. And I think people who read you get the same sort of thing. One of the things that's very difficult to teach and very difficult to write about are rules for pairing wine and food. In classes, Mark and I will come across a wine and people say, well, what would you eat with that? And I'll come up with a bunch of ideas. And I sort of have general rules, but as soon as I come up with them, I find 27 exceptions to the rule. You came up with 7 pairing rules. Talk to us about, is it possible to live in the world with 7 pairing rules and do well with food and wine? And then let's talk about the rules.
Yeah, I was kind of skeptical when I started trying to put the article together. I guess there are exceptions to every rule, and that's, you know, it's true in grammar and it's true in wine pairing. But I really wanted to see if there was a way to simplify and demystify this whole thing, because, you know, we eat every day. In an ideal life, we drink a glass of wine every day with our food, and it shouldn't be, you know, something to stress out over, you know, whether the wine is going to go with the food. And at the same time, some wines do go better with some foods than others. And so I do think it's possible to have some basic rules at hand that actually do work. I mean, once in a while, they might slightly backfire on you, but the 7 I came up with, I'm willing to go to the mat to say that they're pretty effective.
So Ray, do you know how I liked your 7 rules?
How's that?
I brought you on the show. If I were just going to make fun of them, I wouldn't have embarrassed you in person.
So let's talk about your 7 rules, Ray. What are the seven rules that you've published for pairing wine and food?
Yeah, these are they're in our October issue, and the first one is very simple: serve a dry rosé with hors d'oeuvres, kind of. And the reasoning behind that was that hors d'oeuvres, typically if you've got a spread of hors d'oeuvres at a party, you've got everything ranging from crudité to, you know, to cheese puffs to, you know, water chestnuts wrapped in bacon, who knows what. And what you want is an incredibly adaptable wine, and dry rosés, in that they have the, you know, the kind of acidity of white and a little bit of the fruitiness of red, are the most kind of, you know, shortstop-like of wines in a way.
So, and you know, we'll play a little game. Well, I'll pick the wine that is the worst example of breaking that rule. You wouldn't want to, for example, invite people over and start your dinner with passing around hors d'oeuvres and serving a big, fat, oaky Cabernet Sauvignon from California.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would, you know, their palate, they won't be able to taste the food, you know, once you actually get to dinner. And also, it's a little bit like the arms race. I mean, where do you go from there?
Right, right. You can't go
Amarone
back.
Amarone or something.
Well, and for our listeners, it's hard to go from a bigger wine with a lot of power to a lighter wine, because then you don't taste the lighter wine. You always want to go from lighter to heavier.
And I just want to warn our audience, when Ray says a dry rosé, he means a dry rosé. That's not a white Zinfandel that has a little bit of sweetness to it.
Right.
This is a very different wine.
Classic French or more and more American rosés are being made this way. Rosé is very in right now, too. It's got kind of a happy moment for those of us who've always been pro-rosé.
All right, Francis and Mark's pick for best American rosé right now, Etude Pinot Noir Rosé. Ray,
yeah,
yours?
I mean, I would second you. I think it's absolutely terrific. I also, the Linmar makes a terrific one.
Mm-hmm. We're going to put those two up on our website so you can find them. Etude Pinot Noir Rosé, Etude, and Linmar Pinot Noir Rosé. We'll put those up on the website so you can find them. Let's move on to rule number 2. Serve an unoaked white wine with anything you can squeeze a lemon or lime on.
And that's that. The idea there is essentially that unoaked white wines tend to their great strength tends to be acidity. There you've got clean, you know, it's like Sauvignon Blanc, Rieslings, Vermentino from Italy, Albarino from Spain. These are wines that have real zip to the acidity, and they work in a sense on your palate. They work the same way that squeezing lemon or lime does on a piece of fish or something like that. It's a refreshing action on your palate.
So when white wine sees oak, it picks up like vanilla flavors and becomes creamier and richer, and so you know that changes the texture of the wine. So maybe it doesn't go so well with something that you could squeeze a lemon or lime on.
Right, that's the idea. I mean, you know, of course, there's going to be something out there that people squeeze lemons or limes on that doesn't quite fit this. I think you know.
Right, but you're talking about fish. You're talking about
shellfish. You're talking I mean
absolutely. Or and you know and Thai and some of the you know Thai
ceviche.
Cuisines and things like that. It's a
okay, here's a good one. Try with spicy foods, low alcohol wines. And I have always heard that with spicy foods, serve semi-sweet wines, and that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. Why low alcohol?
Well, low alcohol, partly because alcohol, the heat in foods comes from oils, typically. And it's, compounds like capsicum that are in chilies or hot oils, pepper oils and so on. And alcohol essentially acts as a transmission device. It acts as a kind of solvent on them, and actually intensifies the heat of pretty much anything that's spicy.
Not just the heat, but the pain.
The heat, and then consequently the pain. And so why unless you're G. Gordon Liddy, why intensify the pain? It's
All right, this one seems like a no-brainer. It's match rich red meats with tannic reds, like big Cabernet Sauvignon, big young American wines, big Bordeaux. That's a pretty common rule that everybody.
That's a common, yeah. I mean that's one of the basic rules that I just kind of that's
but,
floating out there.
But you put some logic to it, which I liked. You know, you talk about the tannins in those wines because I'm not sure that everybody knows why particularly
or what
those,
a tannin is.
The,
you better
those
explain.
Things work. So Ray, why don't you talk about tannins?
Yeah, tannins in wine. The example I always use is if you want to know what tannins in wine are, take a bag of Lipton's tea and steep it for about 10 minutes. Make an insanely strong cup of tea and take a sip, and that astringent drying effect where your tongue just suddenly glues to the roof of your mouth. Those are tannins, and those are present in wine as well as Lipton's tea. They come from the skins, primarily of the grapes, sometimes the seeds, sometimes the stems, and they give red wines particularly structure, so that you're not drinking fruit juice. You're drinking something that has additional compounds that give it a backbone or a spine to carry that fruitiness.
And those go really well with proteins and the fat of meat.
Absolutely, and what they do, which is wonderful, is they kind of clear your palate. I mean, fatty foods are rich foods like that are hard to eat, just kind of bite after bite after bite because your mouth gets fatigued by all that fat. And this is really almost like like scrubbing bubbles in a sense. It's although it's tannins, it just kind of brings your palate back down to zero where you're ready for another bite of this incredibly rich food.
All right, let's go to rule number five.
With rule lighter, number six. Oh, I'm sorry.
With lighter meats. Pair the wine with the sauce.
Yeah, I actually think this, it's one of the problems with suggesting pairings, and I suggest pairings constantly in the magazine, is that the basic rules that people seem to follow for pairing are, you've got a piece of chicken, what do you pair with chicken? Or you've got pasta, what do you pair with pasta? But the truth is that for some of those lighter flavored meats, the dominant flavor in the dish is going to be the sauce. The classic example is like if you have chicken in a white wine lemon sauce, and you have chicken that's slathered with sweet, intense barbecue sauce. You're going to want completely different wines for those two pieces of chicken.
And a good example is a lot of these sauces use wine. If the sauce uses wine, very very often the wine that's in the sauce is a good match for the dish.
It's a great sort of default jump to if you're cooking with it, you can probably drink it, assuming that you're using drinkable wine.
Okay, we've only got a couple of minutes left before we have to take a quick break. But rule number six is choose an earthy wine with earthy foods. What's earthy?
Earthy is that kind of bottom note that you get, typically mushrooms, a hint of what you would call savoriness. It's connected to that Japanese flavor characteristic, umami, but I didn't want to say umami because I thought that would throw people off.
So
and
it's like
and
that,
a lot
it's
of wines have this as well.
It's that like musty stinkiness almost.
It can be a musty stinkiness. It can be a kind of darkness that's underneath the fruit of the wine, in a sense. You've got that bright berry fruit, and then you've got something kind of deeper underneath it.
I think mushrooms was a great example. If you think about mushrooms, mushrooms have a real earthiness to them.
Well, and to talk about wines that have an earthiness to them, Burgundy certainly, which is made of Pinot Noir, some New World Pinot Noirs. You talk about wines from Piedmont made from the Nebbiolo grape, like Barolo and Barbaresco. And if you ask your wine merchant or your sommelier in a restaurant for an earthy wine, he'll know what you're talking about, or she'll know what you're talking about.
Definitely.
And then finally, quickly, you say for desserts, go with a lighter wine. A lot of people have always said, go with a heavy, sweet wine for dessert. You disagree. Why?
I think that, I disagree. I do disagree. I think that with sweet desserts, really what's better and what's more refreshing is to have a wine that's just slight bit less sweet than the dessert itself. Otherwise, you get this kind of increasing sweetness that really overwhelms your palate.
Yeah, build on each other.
Yeah, and what you want is, it is nice to have a sweet wine with something sweet, but what you want is the wine to be a little lighter so that you get the acidity and freshness of the wine as well. So it's both refreshing and sort of has that unctuous sweetness to it.
And I use, you know, truly sweet wines for, like syrupy sweet wines or fortified wines like port. I like them by themselves, mm-hmm. or maybe with a little bit of cheese.
One of the wines you recommend and grapes you recommend is Moscato, and there's a sparkling wine made with Moscato d'Asti that is my cheat wine at wine tastings. I will go, if after I'm getting palate fatigue from drinking Cabernet after Cabernet after Cabernet, I'll sneak over to the Moscato d'Asti table, take a little sip of Moscato d'Asti. First of all, the bubbles from it being sparkling, but plus that light sweetness from the Moscato helped to clear my palate and set me up for another tasting of red wine.
Hey, listen, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back and talk with Ray Isle about an increasingly popular region in the United States. Two of them. We're going to talk about wines from Italy and wines from Spain. You should know about this back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:47.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Ray Isle, senior wine editor at Food and Wine magazine. We were talking about how to pair wine and food before. We're going to put those 7 rules, Ray, with your permission, up on our website so you can go and print them out and keep them in your kitchen cabinet. Is that all right with you?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Terrific. Now, and we'll also link you to Food and Wine magazine. It's a great publication. We'll put the link up there on our website and you can read Ray's stuff directly. One of the things you've been writing about recently, Ray, is you've been writing about Italian wines and Spanish wines. But let's talk about Italian wines. You haven't been writing about the wines that everyone knows from Italy. I mean, for so many years, you know, we all know Chianti, and then maybe we've learned of Valpolicella, Barolo, Barbaresco. Piedmont, Tuscany, and the Veneto, where those popular wines come from. You've been writing about wines of grape varieties that maybe people aren't as familiar with, which seem to be taking over the Italian wine sections of many wine lists.
They absolutely are, and especially what's nice is that they're taking over, especially at the more affordable level, which is gratifying. If you're like me and you're a journalist, you're not paid a lot. Italy is home. I forget exactly how many thousand different grape varieties there are in Italy, but it really is a couple of thousand indigenous grape varieties, and a lot of them have never gotten much play, obviously, but even some of the great ones haven't gotten much play. So now you're starting to get, you know, Nero d'Avola from Sicily, or Greco di Tufo from Campania, and these are, you know, these are wonderful wines, and Italian wine as a whole has also become incredibly popular in recent years. It overtook French wine as the most popular imported wine a few years back, and I think people, you know, this is one realm where you can explore wine and and find a lot of really interesting new wines and not have to pay a boatload of money for them.
Well, I think one of the things that is our job, certainly, and definitely your job too as a journalist, is to go out there and be able to find places that you might not have explored yet that are going to offer you greater value, greater bang for your buck when you're out buying wine.
Absolutely. I mean, southern Italy is sort of one of the value central regions of wine right now in terms of quality for price, where you can get, you know, you can get some of these wines for $17 or $18, which are just terrific, you know, are the equivalent of $40 or $45 wines. You know, you can get even more affordable ones that are maybe not quite to that level, but are still delicious.
It's hard to get a great California Cabernet or Napa Cabernet Sauvignon for $17. It's hard to find a great one.
Believe me, I've tried.
Yeah.
Well,
I was trying to do an under 20 Napa Cab column. It died on the vine.
Column. If you found two of them, send to where they are. The thing that I find is also interesting is for the novice wine explorer and for the wine professional, you know, the sommelier, the waiter in the restaurant, the wine buyer at the little trattoria, wherever, you've got to go and taste the wines. Because let's face it, you go to a tasting, there's still a lot of garbage out there. I mean, there's still, yeah, as in any region of the world, there's a lot of schlocky wine produced.
Right, there's good Aglianico and there's bad Aglianico.
Right.
But there's so much great stuff that is yet undiscovered, and it's so vast, and there's such variety in Italy, that there are these great $40, $50 bottles in a restaurant, $30 bottles even in a restaurant, that are, you know, $15 a bottle, and even somewhat cheaper. But I think it gets really exciting when you start to pay retail, maybe $15, $20 a bottle from Italy, to go to an unknown region or a grape like Negro Amaro that you haven't heard of before. And even the whites of Italy, I think it's an exciting place because it's not completely explored.
I think it's absolutely true. I mean, it's odd that some place so old and that's had such a wine tradition is just, you know, it, right now is kind of this renaissance of all sorts of new grapes. You know, I keep coming across grapes I've never heard of, which is weird. You know, I've been writing about this stuff for a long time.
Well, we did the same. We expanded our Italian wine selections when we opened Catherine Lombardi, which is an Italian restaurant. We had a traditional American restaurant for a contemporary American restaurant for 13 years when we opened the Italian, and it was opening up. You know, I was able to triple my Italian section. And it was just, it's a fascinating ride for me.
Right,
and
you find out who's growing, you know, growing their vines up into trees and picking them out of trees.
Yeah, Esperino di Aversa. Did you read that article in the Times about Esperino di Aversa, which is they trellis the vines into trees and they pick the grapes with ladders?
Which is, you know, a little more effort than most people want to spend.
Yeah, exactly.
Great.
Well, you just get to go to your liquor store and spend $15 on it. But
that's,
you know,
right. That's the best way to pick
ladders.
The grapes.
Hey, Ray, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. It's always a blast to talk to you. It's been 12 of you to come on the show.
That's true. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ray.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:56. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys.
You know, we were talking before about Italian wines and simplifying this, and I almost feel like the Italians have made it difficult sometimes to read their label. It's so hard to navigate the Italian wines, and part of it is because everybody in each of these little Italian regions is so proud about what they do, and so they want to keep their region distinct from other regions. And, you know, we have... So Sangiovese, grown in Chianti, is called Chianti. Grown in Montepulciano is called Vino Nobile. Grown in Montalcino, it's called Brunello. In other places, it's called Prugnolo. There are just 1,000 different words for the grape Sangiovese, and they're all slightly different strains, and certainly the Italians will tell you that they're as different as they can be, but... For we Americans all trying to make sense of this,
mm-hmm.
it just seems like they're purposely keeping the wines separately named.
If the Germans had taken over Italy, it would have been a lot easier.
No, I read German labels and they're just as hard to read.
But it's all systematic in Germany. No, it's true. But again, that is, thank heaven for that, because mm-hmm. in a world where you know, high score, you know, a wine becomes popular and then it gets high scores and then the price goes into the stratosphere. These wines may be a little difficult to understand, but it's like a great adventure. You don't need to totally understand everything about where it comes from. And it's a great opportunity for your wine sales, your person in your wine shop or your sommelier or you're in the restaurant or business or you're a waiter, to have these in your pocket and to know them really well to bring people along on the adventure.
One quick little tip, if you see like Nero d'Avola, Barbera d'Asti, Moscato d'Asti, Dolcetto d'Alba. Generally, the first word is the grape variety, and the last word is from where it comes.
But not always.
But not always,
welcome,
of course.
Welcome to Italy. I hope you enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 12 noon.